Thank you, Your Honor. As you know, this case is a Warn Act case against Flexible Flyer, who was a manufacturer in West Point, Mississippi, who abruptly closed down on September 9, 2005, and left numerous employees unemployed without notice. This case involves two different issues, two different exemptions, the faltering company exemption and the unforeseeable business circumstance exemption, and as well involves two processes, one the summary judgment and one at trial. In this particular case, the court denied summary judgment, finding that there was a dispute of material fact, where the only evidence we relied upon was the defendant's 30B6 representative. I took his deposition. They did proffer an affidavit from the 30B6 representative, but it really, I don't think, contradicted itself from his prior deposition testimony. But even if it did, this court has found that those type of contradictions cannot be used to get past summary judgment. And there, without some pretty valid explanation, and there has been no explanation for that. We appealed that issue to the district court judge, raised that issue, and the district court judge affirmed the bankruptcy court, but did not even address that issue in the opinion. Another argument that we had brought forward with the issue of the two exemptions is we believe that they are exclusive of each other. One requires that you could not have foreseen the instances coming. And the other one requires that you did see it coming and you made a good faith decision to say, if we gave these employees notice, we wouldn't be able to get the financing we needed on there. You can't have both. One's either unforeseeable or the other one is foreseeable in there. We addressed that to the district court as well. While the court affirmed it, didn't issue an opinion on it, didn't even address that we raised the argument. In this particular case, the company saw, it was really going down every year, losing money. I think at some point it was $70 to $80 million in debt. It was using CIT Corporation to fund its losses to help it get over a hump every year.
What is your argument? Is that the particular circumstances of not being financed or having the finance immediately cut off was foreseeable, or that is not the cause of the company shutting down? I mean, because if you, either way, I mean, it seems to me that you've got a finding of fact.
Sure, exactly. In this situation,
and it was found against.
It was found against us, but where it should have been found is at the summary judgment stage and not at trial, because the facts did not change at trial. On there, they're the same facts we use on, and at trial we only called the 30B6 representative. But to the issue of those facts, in this particular case,
so the judge's error was in denying summary judgment.
Correct. And
when you make that concession, you're saying if we do look at the trial record, and especially the CFO, Michael Erie?
Correct.
At that point, it would be a credibility determination, and he articulated various reasons. No more competitor, and thought I could do it again. He's an optimist, and you would have a much more difficult case to make. So you're asking us to freeze the record at the summary judgment stage, identify the error there. Are you conceding that if we get to the trial record, it becomes really difficult under our precedent?
No, I'm saying, one, you should freeze and you should rule on the summary judgment issue there, because the facts are there and they are undisputed at that point. But even if you get to the trial court record, it doesn't change. It doesn't make it better for the company. In this
the argument that you're making about summary judgment is an argument that's been made two or three times over the last few years when the ultimate verdict is not consistent with the summary judgment that was granted. Do you have a case in which we've actually reversed a judgment of a district court after trial based upon its error in granting or denying summary judgment earlier?
I do not have a particular case off the top of my head where a court has gone back after trial and said summary. Well, no, I take that back. The court has not specifically said this, but I recently had a trial that the Fifth Circuit reversed this year, Renee Akers v. Hines Community College. The court denied summary judgment on my retaliation case. We went to trial and won. The court issued an opinion. And as it's read, the case never should have even been to trial. The court doesn't specifically say that. But
judgment.
Yes. But on to the issues of the facts of the case in this particular situation. This company was in the red every single year. Their main corporation that was funding it had told them, if you don't get in the black, we're going to cut you off. And for several years, they just kept on giving them money, except for the last year. They told them, take a 10% pay cut, then maybe we'll give you some money. And by the way, if you don't get in the black, we're not going to give you any more money. They took the 10% pay cut. The company still didn't give them money. This should have been a clear sign to them to say, hey, we shouldn't be expecting them to come out and bail us out again on there. As well, CIT had already been calling them and telling them about issues with funding and asking them to have...
They knew they were in trouble, and he doesn't deny that. I mean, the company's witness, Mr. Erie, didn't deny that.
Correct. And during his deposition, I asked him, do you have any evidence that would lead you to believe that you were going to end up in the black?
Yeah,
no.
The question, I mean, with some shadings of our opinions, but the question is whether it was caused by unforeseeable business circumstances.
Correct.
Now, you are arguing that this closure was not caused by the denial of credit on the part of Cerebus and CIT. Is that right?
That's correct. It was caused by Cerberus, who was the head corporation, and they said file bankruptcy. They're the ones that made the decision to file bankruptcy. They are the, I guess, decision maker from the company. And the lower corporation, Flexible Flyer, should have seen that coming. It would have...
When did they tell them to file bankruptcy?
I believe they told them to file 2 to 3 weeks before. That's what Mr. Erie testified to. He said 2 to 3 weeks before. And in this situation, even if the court were to find,
When did they say we're not going to... We're simply not going to fund you. Is that the same time they said you filed bankruptcy?
They've been saying that every year, 2 to 3 times a year, and every year they were in the red, but somehow they would keep coming back and funding them.
When did they say, no, we're not giving you another nickel?
At the 2 to 3 week period, we are not giving you another nickel, file bankruptcy.
What happened between the time that they were told they were not going to get funding by Cerebus until they actually gave notice?
I believe at that same time period, that's when CIT cut their funding from to 50% of their receivables. I believe that's all in the same time period. And in this particular case, we're arguing as well that, one...
50%.
Correct.
And there's a much more substantial no more money 2 days before.
Correct.
So in a way, I mean...
They weren't...
You don't cut to 50 if that's the end. You're still a little hopeful, too.
CIT may have been hopeful, but that was based on Mr. Erie's forecast of we're going to be profitable that he's made every year for 6 years, and every year was wrong. The weatherman has better chances than he does. I mean, it's just kind of ridiculous.
And that kind of brings us to an interesting question to me, and I suppose the answer's maybe obvious, but is... do you judge this on the basis of a credibility determination on the part of the trier of fact, or is this somehow we are entitled to look at the undisputed facts and make a legal judgment as to whether it was within the unforeseen
I think you look at the undisputed facts from Mr. Erie and make a legal decision based on what the court believes a reasonable person, not what Mr. Erie decides to do, but what a reasonable businessman would have done.
Or why? What authority do you have for that?
I believe that's what the court will, I apologize, I should have.
You do have some authority for it, I mean, in terms of what we're talking about, just probabilities and not possibilities.
Correctly. That's essentially what we're saying is that it's what is a probability and not just a possibility of what, because Mr. Erie is saying the whole time, well, we think it's possible that Walmart could come out and give us written orders. Even though Walmart has never done it in our entire history, we think it's possible. And they were telling CIT, we think we can get it done. They were lying to CIT, essentially. And CIT was relying on those lies to say, we think, you know, essentially, I mean, I guess maybe it couldn't have been a lie. Maybe he was that delusional to think that he was going to get a written order from Walmart or Kmart or anybody else who had never given him a written order in his entire history.
The word lie, that's a strong word, because I think you'd win this case if the record reflected and the district court or bankruptcy judge had found that he was lying to people around him. That's exactly when you do win.
I don't see how he...
So when you use that word, what's your record authority for that?
Where he had never had anybody tell him, or they had expressly...
That's your interpretation?
No, that...
Anywhere in the record...
That's in the record. In his 30B6 deposition testimony, we asked him, had they ever given you a written order? No. It was their policy. They refused to ever give written orders. So where he was telling CIT, we think we can get the, CIT is saying you're going to have to get written orders, and he's telling CIT to get this funding, yeah, we think we can get these written orders. In my opinion, that's a lie, or at least testimony of a highly delusional person.
Yeah, but the problem is that the bankruptcy judge was sitting in the chair of the finder of fact and didn't think so. So that trumps your opinion a little bit.
Well, I think the evidence that's undisputed, you know, it may be what the bankruptcy court judge decided, but that doesn't mean he can overlook undisputed facts in there. And where we have undisputed facts, where Mr. Erie testified, they never gave him a written order, told him they were not going to give him a written order. But he goes to CIT, and CIT says, you're going to have to get written orders to get this funding. And he said, oh, I think we'll try and do that. I think that's possible. That's not possible. There's nothing in the record that says this is possible in there. And the court, where it relied on, well, they sold these items after it went into bankruptcy, was completely improper. But that's what the court relied on to say that maybe Mr. Erie was right because they sold it after they went into bankruptcy. It's kind of like the Hostess case that's in the news now. No one was interested in buying that now, but now it's into bankruptcy. Well, maybe another corporation may come in and buy it, but that doesn't mean it could have been sold earlier on there. And that's the same situation here, where there was nothing in there to show that there was any financing coming. What amazes me truly is if you look at this case as if this was like a employee salesperson, where they have gone through and not sold something every year, and the employer tells them, okay, I'll give you a bonus this year, but you're going to have to sell something next year. You're going to have to sell something next year. Well, I'm not giving you a bonus this year, and you're going to have to take a 10% pay cut. And eventually that employee gets fired. This court would look at that employee as a fool to come up and say, I didn't expect that to happen. I can't believe I got fired. But that's exactly what this company's done, is they were getting these bonuses, and eventually every year they were losing tens of millions of dollars. And they're like, how did all this happen? We don't understand how we had to get closed. We don't understand why all of a sudden they cut off the funding. That's what's so amazing about this. And there is when you...
Yeah, but I mean, the same thing. I mean, if they'd been telling them, you know, you hadn't made a profit, we're going to cut you off, and they kept pouring the money in, he had no idea. He had a record there that they would keep funding the thing if he could show them some glimmer of hope.
That's correct, until that last year.
Now, if
when they refused.
If you are successful, as a practical matter, are there assets still left there for the employees to be able to collect on these 60 days?
It is possible there are assets there. We took that issue to the bankruptcy court after we lost. There was a $2 million payout to one company, and we had a hearing before the bankruptcy court. I believe that the name of the company was Troxler or Traxler. And the bankruptcy court had essentially ruled that they were going to give that $2 million to Traxler, but if we won on appeal, that there could be a clawback provision so the bankruptcy court could order some of those corporations to pay that money back to pay those employees.
Okay, Mr. Norris.
Thank you, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Mr. Gino, we're here from you.
Good morning, Your Honor. Please, the court. Craig Gino, Flexible Flyer. Just a couple of corrections. Flexible Flyer was never $70 or $80 million in debt. It was in debt for far less than that. And I want to address the summary judgment issue briefly, because that's all we really need to spend on it. In Judge Houston's opinion denying summary judgment, he says, the fact is material if it would affect the outcome of the lawsuit under the governing substantive law. He also says Flex Flyer takes a contrary position to that of the plaintiffs, as set out in the affidavit of Mike Erie, the chief financial officer, that the reduction by CIT of its advance rate to 50% and then immediately after to zero was the unforeseen circumstance primarily causing the closing. Flex Flyer also contends that it was completely unforeseeable that Cerberus would refuse to supply additional capital infusions. As to the faltering company exception, Judge Houston says there are also disputed factual issues. Plaintiffs argue Flex Flyer cannot meet these four elements. Flex Flyer continues to meet each one. Needless to say, evidence must be presented at trial to resolve these conflicting positions. The affidavit of Mike Erie, Your Honors, that Judge Houston relied on to find those factual issues was corroborated at trial. And you're exactly right, Your Honor. If his deposition testimony had differed from his trial testimony and his affidavit testimony had differed from his trial testimony, Mr. Norris would have brought that to the attention of Judge Houston, and he would have found that in his opinion and addressed it. He did not. Judge Houston did not. So the summary judgment issue was correctly ruled on before. In the spring of 2005, there is no question that Flex Flyer had challenges. It had Walmart problems. It had go-kart problems. It had a parent, Cerberus, who said each year, as Mr. Norris correctly says, get in the black or we're going to close you down. But Cerberus never did. Cerberus infused millions of dollars into Flex Flyer. The only way it would ever get repaid is for Flex Flyer to stay open and to stay operating. So it had a vested interest. Was it pushing? Oh, yeah. It was pushing Flex Flyer as hard as it could because of the investment that it had to turn a profit. But it never, when Flex Flyer really, really needed the money, ever turned it down until September of 2005. Cerberus did not, the record reflects, Your Honor, make the decision to close it down 2 weeks before. Cerberus made the decision to close it down 2 days before the bankruptcy was filed, not 2 weeks.
Could you address Judge Jolly's question about do we look at this de novo as to an objective person in the position of the CFO, or do we make it a clear error factual review as to the district court bankruptcy judge's credibility?
Because it's an objective standard, Your Honor, and mainly because the person in the CFO's position must act under the case law in a commercially reasonable manner, I think it has to be a factual determination and has to be a clearly erroneous standard. I don't think commercial reasonableness with the CFO sitting in the position that he set, having to filter through all the financial challenges, all the operational challenges, and the business challenges is a question of law. That's a question of fact for the court to consider, and it's clearly erroneous. Despite all these challenges, Your Honor, Mr. Erie was, according to Judge Houston's opinion, trial opinion at page 11, working tirelessly to overcome them. Considering the effectiveness of Erie's remedial proposals as they actually unfolded, Judge Houston says, his exercise of his business judgment in keeping Flexible Flyer going and in anticipating that Flex Flyer would continue operations into 2006 was, quote, completely reasonable, close quote, page 11 of Judge Houston's opinion, and that was backed up by the facts of the case, Your Honor. No doubt, a lot of challenges in the spring of 2005, but Mr. Erie was not about to give up. Cerberus didn't say give up in the spring of 2005. They kept funding. CIT, contrary to the brief of the appellants and Mr. Norris's argument, never said we're going to cut you off. Mr. Erie's testimony was the reduction in his advance rate from 80% to 50% was unanticipated, And then the cut from 50 to zero was, quote, out of the blue and completely unanticipated. Judge Houston found those credible. As Judge Jolly, as you said, Judge Houston watched Mr. Erie on that stand. He listened to what he had to say. He was the only witness. We didn't hear from CIT. They didn't come into court and say, oh, yeah, we were troubled. We were going to cut them off, but we didn't let them know that. Secretly, we were going to cut them off. We didn't hear Cerberus say, oh, yeah, we made the decision long ago to stop these folks. If they had, they wouldn't have kept funding. Every time the Flex Flyer needed money from Cerberus, except December of 2004, when it found other sources of funding, Cerberus loaned them the money. The proof of trial for Mr. Erie was we kept asking Cerberus for money, and they kept saying, we'll see, we're thinking about it, we'll see, which is what they said every year.
Well, what do you do about the fact that, in hindsight, the expectations of Mr. Erie were completely, just overly optimistic and unrealistic?
They were prior to 2005, Your Honor, but remember, Mr. Erie's projections that he made at Cerberus and CIT's request for 2006 showed profitability. And while Mr. Norris chastises the bankruptcy judge for looking in the future at what actually happened, had Mr. Erie known that CIT was going to cut its advance rate, had he known that Cerberus was going to cut him off completely, here's what he would have done. He would have taken that fitness equipment that was lying around that they weren't in manufacturing anymore, and he would have sold it. We sold it in a bankruptcy sale, a fire sale for $2.3 million. Would have paid off CIT, would have freed up all the receivables at that point to start operating. We sold the go-karts for millions of dollars. We sold the trademarks. We sold lots of property, and that was one of Mr. Erie's proposals in his papers to Cerberus and to CIT. We're going to start winding this business down. That fitness business is sitting on the sidelines. It's not doing anything. Let's see if we can sell it. Got 2.3 in a bankruptcy fire sale. Let's talk about these go-karts. We're getting killed on product liability suits. Let's see if we can sell them. Sold them for $3 million in a bankruptcy fire sale after all the product liability problems. So in the future, Your Honor, I don't believe Mr. Erie's projections would have proven wrong. Even if they had, even if we know now that they did, it was not clearly erroneous that they would have proven wrong. He was not an unreasonable, unobjective CFO sitting in his chair, and Judge Houston certainly didn't find that.
I mean, but it does seem that, you know, if you hadn't made a profit in some 5 years and you owe considerable amounts of money and people have been threatening to cut you off all of this time and you've had to seek all of these different sources of financing and you've even discussed bankruptcy, it was almost delusional to think that he could survive those circumstances. Maybe he thought he would go for another 6 months, but I mean, he had to know that the end was right around the corner.
Remember, Your Honor, in the spring of 2005, Flex Flyer got a huge boost. They became the only domestic manufacturer of swing set, which is his largest volume seller.
When did that happen?
Spring of 2005. They became the only domestic manufacturer of swing set that we have in everybody's backyard, or at least used to. That was a huge boost. Also, the proof in the record, Your Honor, is that Mr. Erie received initial good responses from Walmart, Kmart, Toys R Us, all his other customers about getting written commitments the CIT was so interested in. In fact, his testimony was, I was under the impression that they were going to go along with that. Maybe that's why CIT didn't cut its advance rate until the middle of August of 2005. They got that report, too. Maybe that's why Cerberus kept funding and infusing capital in the business. It didn't stop until 2 days
before. What do you have to say about the so-called lie that Mr. Norris referred to?
Mr. Norris is a good lawyer, Your Honor. If these were lies, he would have proven that at the trial court. Judge Houston is a good trial judge, and he would have said, Mr. Erie's lying. He's not just overly optimistic. He's not just hoping for the future, hoping for a turnaround based on some of these facts. Judge Houston would have found that he was lying. Mr. Norris would have argued that, and he would have proven that.
So you're saying the suggestion to us that he was lying was not even an inference that opposing counsel suggested below?
was not even an inference, Your Honor. It was never brought up.
And you're also saying the statement to us, $70 to $80 million, is simply not supported by the record?
It's simply not supported by the record, Your Honor. There is no indebtedness, nearly that amount of money. We only owe CIT between $2.2 and $2.5 million. They were our only secure creditor.
Yeah, but how much did you owe Cerberus?
We didn't owe them a dime.
Why?
Because they infused money as capital infusions. They didn't infuse it as a loan. Cerberus has not been repaid a dime.
They were never a debtor.
They were never a creditor.
I mean a creditor.
They were never a creditor. They infused money as the shareholder. They infused lots of money, and the only way they could have received their investment would have been if we had made it. They didn't, but they never loaned us a dime. They never filed a proof of claim in the bank.
You never owed them a penny.
We never owed them a penny. Judge Houston, Your Honors, had this case. He had the summary judgment motion. He had the discovery. He had the affidavits. He had everything before him that he needed to make a decision, including the testimony of the only witness that either side called, and that was Mr. Erie. Just a couple of cases I want to mention, Your Honor, from the Fifth Circuit. The General Dynamics case that we mentioned in our papers has a particular fact pattern that's applicable here. In that case, General Dynamics was making A-12 fighters for the Navy. In May of 1990, there were substantial cost overruns because of the cost overrun that General Dynamics was incurring. In June of that same year, months or later, General Dynamics went to the Department of Defense and said, we have huge cost overruns. We have to do something about them. Lots of dialogue, lots of paperwork between General Dynamics and the Department of Defense and the Navy, resulting in January, 7 months later, the Navy notified General Dynamics that it was canceling the contract. This court said, we can only conclude that it is the probability, not possibility. There were lots of flex flyer possible scenarios. There weren't that many probable scenarios. We can only conclude it is the probability of occurrence that makes a business circumstance reasonably foreseeable and thereby forecloses use of the unreasonable foreseeable circumstance. A lesser standard would be impracticable. Since cancellation is a possibility every time there is a cost overrun, defense contractors like General Dynamics would be put to the needless task of notifying employees of possible contract cancellation and concomitant layoffs every time there's a cost overrun. Same here. Flex Flyer clearly was experiencing some financial challenges, had for a number of years. Cerberus kept funding. Every time it was asked, it kept funding. CIT kept advancing money at 80%. Flex Flyer did not want to run to its employees and run the risk of losing employees, as the record, Mr. Erie's testimony, reflects that it would, by giving a WARN Act notice, and it would have to have given it to be effective for 60 days back in July of 2005. Not August or September, it would have been July. And in July, Mr. Erie was receiving lots of good response from his customers about written commitments. His customers had reduced their pay from 60 days to 15 days. The record reflects nobody's ever heard of Walmart cutting its pay time from 60 to 15 days. I certainly never have. He was getting extensions of time from his accounts payable, his vendors. They were extending the time. He was trying to get new business and was getting favorable responses from Walmart, Kmart, and Toys R Us. So the probability in July of 2005, with no word from Cerberus that this time we mean it, we're really going to cut you off, no hint from CIT that they were going to reduce their advance rate from 80 to 50 or 50 to zero, it was not probable that this plant would close. And in fact, it didn't close. It didn't close from July to September of 2005 until at the very end, out of the blue, CIT cuts its advance rate from 50 to zero. Cerberus says 2 days before the bankruptcy filing, we're not going to fund you anymore. All this period of time, Mr. Erie was actively seeking capital, or as you said, Judge Jolly, in the Dillard's case, business, because that's certainly something that he was seeking. All this time he was seeking that. Testimony is uncontradicted. He had a reasonable belief that he would get it, and the testimony is uncontradicted and not really disputed or argued about, that that infusion of capital or that infusion of business that he was seeking, as the folks in the Dillard's case was, would have helped and would have avoided a shutdown. Are there arguments to the contrary? Well, sure. Are they probable? I don't think so. Was Judge Houston clearly erroneous in his factual findings after observing Mr. Erie and looking at all the evidence that was before him? No CIT witness, no service witness? I don't think so. I think you got it right, Your Honor. I don't think the other creditors who loaned good money in the bankruptcy case should suffer for having to pay these employees who got paid in full for all the hours that they worked. Judge Houston was not clearly erroneous, and he got it right in this case. His judgment and the district court's judgment, who looked at this, according to her opinion, pretty closely, ought to be observed. Judge Houston took your admonition, Judge Jolly, in the Dillard's case and says, I need to narrowly construe these two exceptions. I'm going to do that. I did that, and I think Flex Flyer is the winner. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Geno. Mr. Norris, you have some time for rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to correct two issues. Mr. Geno said that Cerberus kept funding. That's not true. Cerberus stopped funding in December 2004. It's clearly in the record where they went to Cerberus and said, please give us some more funding. And Cerberus said, well, if you take a 10% pay cut, we'll give you funding. And they took a 10% pay cut, still did not give them funding. There is nothing, absolutely nothing in the record that said Cerberus gave them any funding in 2005. As well, with regard to the fire sale, they talk about, well, we sold all of this stuff in a fire sale. Not everything, but a lot of that stuff they were trying to sell already and couldn't sell it. They mentioned the swing sets, how they became the only manufacturer in the...
All these are credibility choices. I mean, because, I mean, they say one thing, you say another.
And I'm saying what the record says, not what I say.
You're saying what the record says as you read it.
Correct. And I believe that's how any normal person would read it.
Obviously, we're a little bit, you know, we've read the record excerpts, the briefs, sometimes aren't able to read the whole record. So it's very important for these corrections to be made. What record support do you have that they were $70 to $80 million in debt?
That is Mr. Erie's testimony during his 30s. It's not $70 to $80 million in debt. It was a $70 to $80 million deficit where they had lost money every year, and that equaled up to a $70 to $80 million deficit.
Over all the years, the aggregate?
Correct. That's not anywhere where we've claimed it's a debt, from my understanding. And I went back and looked through my brief. I specifically said deficit, not debt.
And what about, had you drawn the inference in the lower courts that Mr. Erie was a liar?
Yes.
You did suggest that.
We did not use the word liar, but we specifically said, from my understanding, is that, and I don't know how accurate the transcript was, it took us 10 months to get that bench trial transcript, and a lot of the questions that says I asked were actually asked by Mr. Geno and vice versa, and there's a lot of things in the transcript I don't think made it. But we tried to go back and get a copy of the transcript or a copy of the audio, and we couldn't listen to it. That court reporter has since retired by the bankruptcy court, we'll just put it that way, and after he lost another transcript later on in another case. But I
doctors put him in jail.
Well,
exactly.
In this particular situation, yes, we did infer that he was essentially not being truthful to CIT in that essence. We did not use the word liar, from my understanding. I don't think I ever used the word liar in there, but we inserted that he was saying he could get these
Wildly optimistic, euphemism delusional.
That he should not be able to, you know, that no sane person would argue. With regard to the swing sets, they talked they were going to be the only manufacturer, and we were going to be able to sell these swing sets. Okay, well, that's true. In the spring of 2005, they became the only manufacturer. In the spring, they didn't sell them. In the summer, they didn't sell them. For 6 months, they didn't sell them. If you're not selling things for 6 months when you're the only manufacturer...
What happened to the swing set market? I mean, people just don't buy those things anymore.
Well, what they were doing is they were the only manufacturer in the United States, and they were buying them from China, was what happened.
What?
They were buying them from China. They were the only swing manufacturer in the United States. That's what they're inferring to. And they thought they could get a capitalization on the market because they were only manufactured in the United States. And, in fact, what happened was is they weren't buying them from them. They were buying them from China. And that's the problem. And they saw that. And any reasonable person would have said, well, you know, our plan wasn't working out. But they said, well, we'll just keep on trying. And that's fine. That's great for them to do that. I admire somebody trying really hard. But at the same time, you have to look at reality and say, we're not going to make it. You know, we can try as hard as we can, and maybe we'll win the lottery. You know, we'll be one of these lucky businesses that pulls this out. But, you know.
Okay, are you saying they should have given notice then?
June 1, 2005, when their go-kart business went down, where they had already ended up in the red to begin in the spring. But when the go-kart market went down, that was essentially the sign that there was nowhere.
You mean when they had the recall?
Right, when they had the recall. That was the clear sign. There was no possibility. It didn't matter just about how much they sold. I mean, unless Walmart was going to come out of the blue and defy the logic that they had been using for all the years and give them millions of dollars in orders, that would have been the only way they would have ended up in the black. And Cerberus had already.
I think we had.
Oh, I apologize. Thank you, Your Honor.
Call the next case of the day.